Low in the low 60s and a south wind from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Friday, partly sunny with a high in the low 80s. Friday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Look for a low in the upper 60s. Saturday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The high will be in the mid 80s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the low 60s to the low 80s. At Rockford, 68. O'Hare reported 69 degrees. It was 66 at Peoria, 70 at Mattoon, 83 at Carbondale. In South Bend, 62. Lafayette, 68. Indianapolis, 64. And Terre Haute, 67. Willard Airport reported a cloudy sky at the top of the hour, 67 degrees. The dew point, 62. The relative humidity, 84%. The wind out of the southeast at 13. And the barometric pressure, 29.78 and rising. And at 12:38, 68 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. In Iowa, crews worked through the night racing against the clock to save a tiny town along the rising Missouri River. Communities in several states are threatened by heavy rains and melting snow that have swelled the river this year. Hamburg, Iowa is of particular concern this week following the breach of a nearby levee. Now officials are working to build up a second earthen levee just outside town. From Hamburg, Iowa Public Radio's Sarah McCammon reports.
Dave Ray's voice is hoarse. Yours would be, too, if you'd been shouting over noisy earth-moving equipment at sites all along the Missouri River all month. Ray is a geotechnical engineer with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Omaha. He says crews have been racing to build up the earthen levee.
So they're raising it up another 3 feet from our original design, and they've got good clay material close to the site, so that cuts down on haul distance and time, and he's working 24 hours to raise the thing up.
So I'm on the western side of Hamburg, about a quarter mile or so, maybe west of town, surrounded by kind of a soybean field, looks like, and a lot of earth movers just moving dirt, kind of digging up this field and turning it in the dirt into a wall that hopefully will hold back the floodwaters.
So we've got every confidence that we're ahead of it enough to stop the water from coming into Hamburg and flooding the area. So,
how confident are you that this levee will hold?
I'm real confident. They're placing it as well as we can with the equipment and time we have.
Melting snowpack in the Rocky Mountains, way above normal, has prompted the Corps to release water from upstream reservoirs. And that's causing flooding headaches downstream in the Dakotas, Nebraska, Iowa, and Missouri. Recent heavy rains in Montana and North Dakota aren't helping either. Throw in this levee breach, and the town of Hamburg could be in trouble. 22-year-old Nathan Beach drove here from Lincoln, Nebraska, where he's attending college. He came to see the town for what he fears will be the last time. Beach has lots of memories traveling here from his childhood home in eastern Iowa.
I'm here to visit Hamburg because I think it might be flooding soon, and I want to see the place where I came here as a child. My grandparents used to live here. My grandfather used to have a watch shop here, so I want to visit the town, see where their house used to be, and maybe see it before it all got inundated.
The town is mostly quiet now. At least half of its 1,200 or so residents have already left. But down the road at the elementary school, volunteers are chipping away at a mountain of sand in the parking lot, filling burlap bags one shovel full at a time. Tyler Woodward says many of those who remain say their homes are safe, but they want to do something to help their neighbors.
We live up on the hill, so we're fine there. We evacuated our business down there on the bottom. Most farmers moved out all their equipment and stuff out of their shops, and now all the homes are evacuated down there behind the levee, and then south end of town is evacuated pretty much too. So
it's not clear how long this town will stay largely empty. Predictions are that Missouri River levels will remain unusually high well into August. For NPR News, I'm Sarah McCammon in Hamburg, Iowa.
An estimated 250,000 teachers face layoffs in the coming year as states cut school funding to balance budgets. That number comes from the American Association of School Administrators. Many teachers name job uncertainty as one of the biggest downsides of the profession. NPR's Larry Abramson spent time with two teachers in Los Angeles who are worried about their next paycheck.
At Graham Elementary School in South Los Angeles, drama teacher Misty Monroe gets to see students during a rare moment in their day. When she's teaching them, they aren't angsting over some high-stakes test.
Today, let's have you line up like pirates.
Misty Monroe is an itinerant drama teacher. Every day, she visits a different L.A. school and brings a little art into kids' lives. Despite 8 years with the L.A. Unified School District, Monroe has gotten an unwelcome present at the end of this year, a layoff notice.
This will be my second year.
Many school districts are required to send out layoff notices in the spring, even if they think they will rehire workers. Many teachers are recalled over the summer. That's what happened to Misty Monroe last year. But she says the suspense of having unemployment hanging over your head is unnerving.
The sad part is that morale dips so drastically once the pink slips go out, because the worry begins about family, mortgage, and stuff like that.
Whether the cause is budget cuts or shrinking enrollment, some teachers face this prospect year after year. Despite all the hubbub about union contracts and how tough it is to fire bad teachers, junior teachers have little protection against the layoff acts. Just ask Roya Prudhomme. After 4 years with the Los Angeles Unified School District, Prudhomme gets the same letter every spring.
For the past 3 years, I've gotten a pink slip every single year.
At her apartment in downtown Los Angeles, Roya Prudhomme pulls out this year's personal communication from the school district.
As you may be aware, the Los Angeles Unified School District continues to face a dire financial situation. While the district hopes that solutions may be found to mitigate this crisis, it is with sincere regret that I must send you this letter at this time.
Getting a job at the Miguel Contreras Learning Complex was the fulfillment of a dream. Prudhomme teaches English here. It's a big urban high school full of mostly low-income students, just the population she wants to serve. Her supervisor here, Nova Mesa, says it's just a bad time.
You can't blame the district. You can't blame, I guess, the schools necessarily. I just feel like education in the state of California is in dire straits.
Many blame state laws and union contracts that say teachers must be laid off according to seniority. But many teachers I spoke with say ending seniority rights just isn't the answer. That would just make them feel more insecure. In addition to teaching sophomore English, Prudhomme runs what's known as an advisory, a group of students who stay with her throughout high school. Junior Jackie Vasquez came to a park near downtown to talk about the fate of her favorite teacher. Vasquez says she has struggled in high school, but Prudhomme stayed on her.
She's always asking me, how am I doing? How are my other classes? She always pushes me.
You need that.
Yeah, I do. Because I just tend to slack off and not care.
Prudhomme took Jackie and some other students on a college tour of Northern California last year at her own expense. They will be among the first in their families to go to college. Jackie knows that getting into the University of California at Berkeley would be a reach for her, but she is jazzed by the prospect.
Berkeley, wow. Well, Berkeley was a beautiful place, like a place where it was very liberal. You know, you could be whatever you want, you could do whatever you want, and you're not going to be judged.
Roya Prudhomme could search for jobs in other districts, but all of them are facing budget pressures, and she'd have to give up what little seniority she has. Charter schools are another option she's considering. But for now, she's stuck on her school and on the kids here and doesn't want to leave. So until school ends later this month...
I teach as though I don't have a pink slip. I teach as though I'll be teaching forever.
Larry Abramson, NPR News.
100 years ago, the white-tailed deer was a rare creature along the East Coast. Now they seem to be everywhere. Across the country, there are some 20 million white-tailed deer. Many states are seeing record populations, and these populations are expected to grow. That has had big implications for road safety and gardens. Now there are new warnings about the implications for biodiversity and the long-term survival of forests. Sabri Ben-Ashour has the story.
Back in 1990, scientists with the Smithsonian's Conservation Biology Institute in Front Royal, Virginia, closed off about 10 acres behind an 8-foot-tall wire fence. It's called an exclosure. It's a world without deer, and it doesn't really exist anymore anywhere else. Bill McShay is a wildlife ecologist with the Smithsonian, and after passing through a rickety wire door, he's standing in that world.
So here we're inside this deer exclosure. We're at the fence line here. And this fence has been up now for 21 years. So we're comparing inside the fence to the outside the fence. And there's two things to notice. One is it's green on both sides of the fence. But in here, it's a lot more diverse than out there.
That is an understatement. The deer side of the fence has a carpet of grass, a shrubby-looking thing, and some large trees, things that are either too big for deer to eat or are among the very few plants they don't like to eat. Inside, it is practically a jungle. Dozens of different, almost exotic-looking plants are tumbling over one another. Many of them are young trees.
In here, I can see white ash and hickory and red maples and serviceberry. We're looking at 20, 30 species. You look out there, it's a much simpler world.
And that simpler world is an aging world. Really, it's a dying world as far as forests go.
The future is not good. There is no teenagers here. There's no young adults. Everybody's a mature individual. Whereas inside this fence, you have the complete profile of ages. You have youngsters. You have teenagers. You have middle-aged adults. You have the old trees. And when the old trees go, there is something here to take its place. Out there, I don't see anything out there that's a small tree.
One of the surprising things they found with this experiment is that deer allow invasive species to flourish. And with fewer native plants, there are fewer birds who depend on them for nests and food. There are fewer mice and fewer chipmunks when they have to compete with deer. It wasn't always this way. 100 years ago, deer were nearly extinct in Maryland and extremely rare in Virginia. Newly minted state game departments rushed to the rescue, banning or regulating hunting and setting up parks.
They went and got deer from Arkansas and brought them back here to repopulate that area. So growing the deer population was intentional. It's a conservation story, and it went just like they planned. And now the flip side has happened.
Deer aren't evil, McShay is quick to emphasize, but they don't have any natural predators anymore, and they need to be managed. States rely on hunters and even hired sharpshooters, but McShay says in order to protect the long-term health of forests, a wider, more aggressive approach is necessary.
We have time in that. We don't have to make a decision this year.
But, he says, we don't have decades. Trees don't live forever. For NPR News, I'm Sabri Benishore in Washington.
It costs about $15 to broadcast a minute of programming on WILL. Programs like Morning Edition, Focus, and Classic Mornings are made possible by listeners who give a few minutes of financial support for their favorite program. You can help WILL reach its membership goal of 2.1 million.